Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Once again, we're joined by Mike Cantu, Inland Empire investor, former builder, and property holder. Rick Solis, appraiser for the Norris Group's inventory. He holds property, buys notes, and buys and sells on occasion. And Tony Alvarez began as an appraiser, buy, sell, buy, hold, little commercial building, and also in the education business with Mike. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, Bruce.
We just ended a conversation. I just wanted to touch on the rental inventory. So typically, what is the – what? Rick, we'll start with you. Give me the prototype inventory. Is it typically always going to be a three-bedroom wherever you are?
No. In the market that I'm in now, in the high desert, you know, I actually meet the tenants. I talk to them. Not all of them. I mean, my business partner handles most of it, but I do – meet quite a few, and I talk to them. And when you're meeting them at the property and asking them what they don't like about it or what they do like about it, you start to get a sense of, you know, what they're looking for. So for me, the stuff I like up there, usually nothing without two baths. I don't care if it's one bedroom, two bedroom, has to have two baths. Nothing without a garage. I almost wouldn't take that for free up there. And I prefer three bedrooms and no small bedrooms. They don't like, a small bedroom is a deal killer. Even if you drop the rent $200-$300 a month, if they can't fit their king size bed in that master bedroom, they're not taking it up there.
And what are you getting for those type of that type of inventory?
The three bedroom, two bath, like 1,100 square feet to like 1,400-1,500 square feet, we're getting $1,000 a month.
Okay.
If there's a fourth bedroom that can be squeezed anywhere in that house, even if it's a non-permitted fourth bedroom off the back of the house, we get $1,100.
Okay.
And we're about $50 less than most landlords. And we have upgraded things to granite counters, and we are putting in a wood laminate flooring that's cheaper than tile. Those two items seem to just line the tenants up. We will knock out every other landlord within a 20-mile radius with just those two amenities. And that extra $2,000 or $3,000 we spend on that, we make up for just in the speed that we rent that and the quality of tenant that we're able to get.
I've seen pictures of some of the properties that the yards seem to be optional.
No yards. We tear everything out.
That's called desert landscaping.
Yes.
Okay. All right, Mike, what about you? Give me the range of inventory that you'll touch as a rental.
I have totally different criteria than Rick. First and foremost, I'm a lot buyer. It's all about the location. I like a premium lot. The house is secondary. My attitude's always been location first, structure second. I have lots of two-bedroom houses. In fact, some of my A-plus top 10 product that I've owned for years and years are two bedrooms. Two-bedroom, one bath, 1,000 square feet, but they're on half-acre lots in a neighborhood where houses range anywhere from my little houses up to 10,000 square foot houses. So it's the dirt that I'm after. The house wears out, the dirt goes up in value. Two identical houses, same builder, one in Barstow, one in Newport Beach. You know how the story plays out. The houses wear out, the dirt goes up, and Newport Beach will win out over Barstow 100% of the time. So I don't have a problem with two bedroom houses. I'm very, very big on school district. A one-bath house, whether it's a 2-1 or a 3-1, people will overlook lack of the second bathroom and deal with the inconvenience to get their kids in the right school district if they can afford it. Parents are very concerned about where their kids go to school, so I make it a habit of shopping in the neighborhoods with the good school district. And the two-bedroom, one-bath, I'm getting the same rents, if not a little more. I get $1,095 for the typical 2-1 that we're buying these days, and $1,195 for the 3-1s on the east end of my marketplace, quite a bit more on the west end. And I don't have that much turnover. Some of my longest tenants have been around in two-bedroom, one-bath houses. It's just you've got to look for the right setup to live in that house, no overcrowding, and once somebody gets comfortable in a two-bedroom, one-bath house, they'll stay for a long time. I know myself as a single adult, I live in a two-bedroom, one-bath house. Actually, mine's a 2-2, but I never use the other bathroom. It's a guest bathroom. And the house that sits on the property of my office that's very premium lot, that's a two-bedroom, one-bath house.
But you drive a car with 400,000 miles on it. So.
That is true.
I'm not living in a mobile home.
Okay. So very different inventory type. And I wonder if it's the end game for you is never to get rid of those homes, where the end game for you is really different in the sense that you want to have an escalation of price and say, see y'all later.
If I own those houses in 2020, I'm going to be very sad.
Okay. Whereas I look forward to driving down these tree-lined streets in the neighborhoods where we've collected stuff. That's one of my criteria. People, they walk in the morning, walk in the evening. There's joggers. They're actually jogging, not being chased by somebody. And it's just a pleasant environment.
Well, Tony, let's talk about your area. Anybody jogging
anybody
in your area?
Anybody running in mine? There's no jogging. Anyone that it looks like jogging, he's running.
They look like they're training for the Olympic sprint.
Yes. Huh? And if they're holding a television, you know, check your house. No, our area has actually changed quite a bit, you know. But to get back to the question that you had as far as the inventory, the only thing that's off the table for us is probably the condos. Right now, the only condos in my market are, you know, they're just too many within a small geographical area. You got way too many managers. You know, each investor is buying a couple, this and that. The percentage of rentals to owner occupied is not good. So I stay away from that. Unless I can, I'm telling you, the last time around I bought like two bedroom, two bath condos for, you know, $10,000. When the prices get to that kind of level, I'll probably buy some stuff, and I'll buy a lot. What I'll try to do is buy enough so that I can control what's going on with the management in there.
Yeah.
But I buy two bedroom, one bath houses, three bedroom, one bath. There's a lot of three bedroom ones in our area in certain markets. Mostly, you know, Spanish, Hispanic neighborhoods and stuff like that, which I grew up in those neighborhoods. So, and then we buy stuff on the west side as well that ends up getting rented to, you know, engineers and stuff like that. So what I've learned, and another thing that, going back to your earlier question, that I would do different is I buy a combination of properties, meaning some of them are on the lower end of the economic scale, some are in the middle, and some are on the upper end for our market, okay? I don't want to compare with Upland or nothing like that, but
so 90-plus.
Yeah, but you know, what I found is that it gives us a better blend as far as the income and stuff that we have coming in. So some of the higher-priced stuff, maybe we don't get, you know, as much dollar per square foot, but we make up for it with some of the lower-end stuff. So,
How dominant is Section 8, let's say, of your rentals?
It used to be, the last time around, was probably about 90% of what I did.
And now?
Right now, it's probably running 50%, maybe just 50, maybe a tad below that.
What about Rick?
We try to avoid Section 8 just because we found the inspection periods are rather... We lose a couple months of rent just waiting for the inspector to come out there, get it approved. And it's just the tenants, we haven't been as happy with those tenants. So we don't do Section 8, although, you know, I'm not opposed to it. If I found a great Section 8 tenant and they could be in there and paying rent the day that, you know, house was finished, I would take that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you, I see, and this also is a difference because is your stuff L.A. County still?
San Bernardino County.
Okay, so that is a difference I want you to know because I found that over the years, the L.A. County Section 8, for whatever reason, they tend to move quicker. They're more efficient. We have a separate office, like a satellite office, out in the Antelope Valley, and they tend to be pretty efficient. And also one thing is how closely you get to know those people and how closely you work with them makes a heck of a lot of difference in how quickly they service you.
In San Bernardino County, the Section 8 people also work at the DMV, so we have the same thing. They work as fast as the DMV. It just takes them a long time to move.
Mike, you have Section 8 at all?
I have zero Section 8 tenants. I've never rented to a Section 8 person. I have nothing against it. I've inherited several.
Yeah, I can tell.
I've inherited several Section 8 tenants over the years, and I'm batting 1,000 as far as losing those people because every time we had an inspection, I'd get a list of corrections handed to me, and I'd go down the list and check off what I was responsible for. That's the stuff that wore out. But anything that was broke, I would ask the tenant and the Section 8 inspector, when were they going to fix it? They would explain that to me that Section 8 doesn't fix stuff. I would explain to them, it's my experience that houses don't break themselves. People break things, and if they're not going to take responsibility for it, we're not going to continue the relationship. I'm batting 1,000. I've lost them all over that little speech I give.
Now you go. You meet people that are prospective renters at their current residence. Is that anything that you do?
After I get an application and everything checks out on the application, then I will pull a surprise drop by their house. Now, occasionally I'll pull up in front to where everything is just perfect looking. Cars in order, yards in order, to where I won't even, I think, okay, I see how they live, and I verified that they've been there for years. And more often than not, I'll go up and knock on the door early evening, and first thing they do is open the door, big surprise look, they jump out on the porch and shut the door behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm not invited in, they're not going to be invited back into my house.
Okay. All right, let's shift a little bit and talk about inventory levels that we think might be coming. You just read something about an article last time we got together.
Right.
And so have you had conversations with the REO agents that anybody's dealing with where they get a sense that they're going to be much busier next year?
You know, I've always been optimistic about this happening. And it's simply based on the last time around back in the 90s and even before that, back in the 80s, I, having worked inside for lenders, I kind of developed a pretty good understanding of the rhetoric and how closely bankers and politicians seem to communicate. They kind of use the same kind of tactics in when they go to present something, what they say and what they mean, in other words. So when I would read these articles, you know, what I've interpreted is they really want to release this inventory, but they keep throwing this back and forth between each other. And it's almost like a control thing. You know, the politicians are using it in some, like a political football. Bankers really have had no motivation to really do anything, from what I can see. I mean, as long as they got all this money handed to them to really just sit there, I mean, what's the point? Now that this relationship seemed to be kind of changing a little bit, and this happens in all relationships, you know, that start out like this, kind of bribing each other's love, it kind of falls apart. So what I see is this article came out the night of the election. I mean, they didn't even wait for the election results.
Mm-hmm.
And already, this is what I call a crab walk being done by the Obama administration. I think they're going to release more inventory. It's inevitable. I mean, what are they going to do with it? You know, keep it as rentals for the government like they were saying that they would? I think that's highly unlikely. If they were to go down that road, it's going to be the same disastrous results that they've had with every stupid idea that they've come up with, which has all been politically motivated, trying to garner votes. Here's what I think is going to happen. They're going to try to get this stuff out there as fast as they can between now and 2012, because that's a new election coming. And so they are well aware that they have to get the pain felt and out of our memories as quickly as possible, because as Americans, we do have short-term memories when it comes to this kind of stuff. So, but here's what I think. The cut's too deep, and it's just too wide. And no matter what they do to release inventory now, we're still going to remember this come 2012.
Yeah, this one's a big one. This is going to have some...
Right.
We're going to recall this one for a little while.
Yeah.
But what you're saying, I think, is you expect perhaps 2011 to be...
Absolutely.
I mean, if you're going to have a hard year, you wouldn't want it to be 2012.
No. I think this year, and relatively quickly, I don't think it's going to take, you know, another new normal, so to speak. I think what you're going to see in the coming months is, you know, we had a bill that they were trying to pass, which would have squashed all of these cases, you know, where they were challenging how the foreclosures were done and all this. Granted, there may be some foreclosures where the paperwork wasn't done, but let's be honest. If you went back historically and you looked at every single foreclosure before any of this disaster happened, you'd probably find just as many that were done, you know, where they missed this or they didn't have that or whatever the heck it was. The bottom line is this. You sign a note to make payments on something. If you stop making the payments, you should get foreclosed on. That's the end of the story. Now, what I see is they have no other... What other monkeys are they going to put out of their hats here? This article that says, hey, they're changing their tune, is the first flag. And the fact that they put it out the evening of the elections is, in my opinion, was a strategic hit.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're so busy with the election, nobody's really reading this article.
Mike, do you talk to REO agents that give you a sense of inventory levels they're being told are going to come out?
And I get totally different feedback. It depends on which agent I'm talking to. There's a few agents I deal with that are pretty darn pessimistic right now, and then there's always the bubbling optimists. As usual here, the government's going to be the wild card in this. And the one thing that will never change in real estate is change. The market is always changing, and I think we're going to see lots more of that. Now, I have noticed a difference in the inventory that I've been looking at the later part of this year. They're letting go of a lot of strange, derelict inventory. A couple of Saturdays ago, I went out and I looked at 18 houses. Typically, 8 out of 10 will make the cut that I'll make some kind of an offer on. 5 out of 18 made the cut that I was within a reasonable price of the asking price. 13 of them went straight to the trash can, and I thought that was the biggest pile of derelict houses that you don't want to get stuck with that stuff in this market. I had a walkthrough on a house yesterday that from the street everything looked good. It was an occupied house. Right neighborhood, right everything. Well, I went in the house and I was thinking, this house is mine. $67,000, I'll take two of them. That was a good house. And then we got to the backyard and I realized it backed up to an elementary school. Big sandbox right on the other side of the fence. The classrooms were there, and when the bell goes off, and then I looked at the two-car garage. It had grown two glop-ons off of the side and one off the back. And when I went in there, I realized that was actually a four-bedroom, two-bath, complete and other residence with about eight people living in it. So from the street, good looking. As soon as we got in the backyard, I thought, oh, it's everything that I don't want in a house, and I passed on it.
Okay.
So just strange inventory out there.
But not necessarily a promise of a lot more from the people that are controlling. What, Rick, do you have any contacts that you talk to?
I talk to people all the time, and I get so many different stories that, oh, the flood's coming, oh, it's a drought, and then I stop paying attention. I really just focus on what is today. If I see a trend developing, I'll go with that, but I don't put a lot of effort into it.
Bruce, just one thing that I wanted to mention, I look at indicators like you've taught me, really. I learned that from you, to look at specific things and then try to interpret what those things mean. Two things that have occurred that I got from REO agents in my area, and one that I'm very close to, and we have a real trusting relationship. I went to visit him under a different pretense. I was going to film him for an interview I was doing. When I walked in, he's beet red, says, come in, sit down, close the door. And that means trouble to me, usually, like I did something,
you did something wrong. Yeah.
So I was a little nervous, and he says, you won't believe what I just got here. And he throws across the desk something called a silent memo that he got from Fannie Mae. It basically said, we're hiring. Because we're federal agencies, we're having to comply with federal regulations, and the REO agents that we're going to hire have to pretty much resemble or mimic the landscape that we have out here. So if we have 20% African-American, we got to have 20% African-American, whatever, or Hispanic or whatever. So the bottom line is we're going to be hiring new REO agents. Plus, here's the kicker, you have to train them. If not, you're going to lose your whatever. That, to me, signaled the fact that they didn't fire any of the existing REO agents, yet they were hiring more and training them. And they've been doing that in my area.
Right.
That's one point. Two, and one of the things I wanted to mention, because both Rick and Mike said that they hear different stories from different people, you have to become aware that right now there's a difference between a real, quote, real REO agent and also an imposter. And the imposters are basically companies that are buying bulk. And they're forming their own companies. And a lot of them are like named like Atlantic and Pacific. I see that a lot. I see one company in our area. And if you do the research on their listings, it's usually an agent. He's representing like this one bank, Atlantic, Pacific, whatever. And if you look and you look a little bit further into the ownership of those properties, they're all owned by such and such holding company.
Okay.
All the same owners. These guys are flooding a lot of their inventory. They're basically buying bulk and then throwing it out there at really high prices. And what I found out is that they're buying non-performing notes, not houses.
Right.
And then if they can't work it out or whatever, they foreclose and they bring that inventory to the market. That's not what I consider to be a true REO agent.
No.
And the information you're going to get from them sometimes is not accurate, or anybody working in that office, for that fact.
What's interesting about that is that if they're buying $150 million of notes, then that inventory doesn't hit the market in a typical way. It won't be an REO that's going to go to 20 different agents. It's going to go to that one company.
Right.
So that has become more popular. Okay, time remaining, let's talk a little bit about the education world. Actually, Rick has grudgingly gotten into getting in front of our boot camp, and they love him, so it won't be long. It won't be long before I can see an appraisal seminar.
I enjoy doing it. I'm surprised that I like doing it.
Yeah, no, they get a big kick out of it, too. So what part of your success would you attribute to education by other trainers? I'll start with you, Mike, since I think you've probably gone to every seminar that's...
I make the comment, as long as I'm in the game, I will be a student of the game. I typically go to 8 to 12 seminars a year. And I have for as long as I can remember. I heard years ago, if you work hard on a job, you get paid money. But if you work hard on yourself, you get paid a fortune. And I've always liked that quote, and that was always been my goal. And the bubble riders, I see so many of those people still in trouble. And when I see them in trouble, I'm always asking myself, I wonder how much they invested in their own education. I think that my entire net worth is the result of the education that I have. Of course, taking action to follow up with the education, that's the critical part of it. But I like a good mixed variety of education. I don't like to be slanted one way, so I try and get all the good education I can. I read every day and just try and stay on top of this. I figure that I'm in this for life, and as long as I'm involved, I'm going to keep educating myself.
Favorite trainer?
There's several of them, but my all-time favorite trainer was Jack Miller. Jack passed away last year. I say, Bruce, you're in my top four favorite people there, alongside of John Schaub and Pete Fortunato.
That's tall cotton, as they say, so I appreciate that. What about you, Tony?
You know, I have I really have not taken a lot of education. I have, in a sense of saying, to go to like seminars like Mike has done over the years. And he picked specific people to follow, and he went hardcore. I got involved in real estate as a result of listening to an infomercial late at night from somebody who later, you know, Dave Deldado, who people say never bought a house, you know. But he's got great wine nowadays up in Napa. I did go by there, okay? I wanted to get a picture of him and me for the book, but I didn't get to have that. But after that, I mean, I did things like buy Carlton Sheets' Course twice, you know, never really finished reading it, stuck it someplace. I was really about getting out there and doing things and falling all over myself with action. Then I met you, and I have to tell you, and I'm not saying this to, you know, kiss your butt here and on the radio, but, you know, you made a significant change for me dollar-wise and also in my education. Two things, and I learned from you, also learned from Mike. Mike kind of, you know, I followed up with him afterwards, was, you know, going directly to absentee owners and that kind of thing. You opened my eyes to, instead of just the REO market, which is what I was, 100% REO. And I have to tell you, 90% of all the money I've ever made was in the REO market.
Right.
You made a significant change for me in that area where you said, hey, look at some of these owner sellers, which I had done a little bit of. And you also opened my mind to timing markets, which I had never really thought about in that detail. I thought about it a little bit, you know, when the price gets up there, get the heck out. But I never knew when you told me, hold on, it took every ounce of energy in me to really do it. Okay?
Yeah, and then you went the other direction.
Yeah.
I remember the phone call. He's got like 80 properties, and he says, Bruce, when do you think the exact month is that I should sell this stuff? I said, gee, when he Christmas, 80 houses, you'll change the market by yourself.
No. And then you said to me, you need to get out now. And you said exactly what you said to me was, Tony, you need to, what do you want to sell to? A euphoric market or a market that just doesn't want to buy your stuff? And that made the distinction in my mind, which I really hadn't thought about, because I kept thinking,
you got to sell early.
Yeah. So I would say, as far as my, you know, the person that I listen to the most is you. And you've earned that position, because I've made $3 million, counted every penny, as a result of 10 words that you told me. And it was basically just hang on there just a little bit longer. So, you know, other than that, I really have to owe again to you, because I met these guys. Would I meet Rick? Would I meet Mike? I met him at your seminars. So it's not only the guy who's teaching the class, but also the other folks that are going there. Yeah,
absolutely.
You know, the other investors.
Okay, Rick, 30 seconds.
I've been books and tapes and seminars since I was a teenager, including Dave Deldado. I have slowed down on the seminar stuff. I was a junkie and went to all that stuff. But in the last 3 or 4 years, there's only one guy that I go to seminars, and it's yours, Bruce. You're in my market. I want to hear your market timing. I want to know exactly what you guys are doing. And I went from buying one or two houses a year before I met you to buying one or two a month. So I appreciate it.
My pleasure. And I'm glad you guys are all in the education space, because everybody needs to hear your story, and we all have a different twist to it. So Mike Cantu, Rick Solis, and Tony Alvarez, thank you for joining us on our 200th anniversary show, and I'm sure we'll do it again soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bruce.
All right.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.